Welcome to our year in review of Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Today, we have a batch of stories our reporters picked as their top news items of last year. We'll hear how wildfire managers anticipated a busy summer after a flurry of spring burns got the season started early.
You know, I'd like to see as much participation as we possibly can get.
We'll revisit the early days of a program that aims to work with Native families to address grief and intergenerational trauma.
A lot of our adolescents are struggling, and they don't understand like where the grief is coming from.
And we'll dive back into the mysterious illness that left dozens of cows nearly unrecognizable.
I described it as like bloody tapioca pudding.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to our year in review of Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. We're going to start today's episode with some time travel. We're going back to March of last year when white supremacist trolls had been targeting the Laramie City Council for nearly half a year. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor says this story allowed him to ask important questions.
When white supremacists launched a campaign to disrupt city council meetings in Laramie, I saw that those attacks wasted more than just time. In this feature for March, I got to ask what those attacks meant for democracy in the Mountain West.
Let's hear his report.
On a Tuesday night last October, a night just like any other, the Laramie City Council gaveled in for its regular meeting.
Good evening, everyone. It's October 17th, 2023, and I'm going to call this.
It was more or less a normal meeting for the council. That was until Mayor Brian Harrington cut to Zoom for public input. It was at that point the council was flooded with hateful comments. One of these Zoom commenters gave a false name and a false address before launching into a rant about atheists, Jews, and how America is allegedly getting away from its Christian roots. Harrington cut him off.
Mr. Hess, for one, 1488 Park Boulevard does not exist in the city of Laramie. And also the anti-Semitism will not be welcomed in this council.
But those comments were simply a taste of things to come. At the next meeting, it happened again. More anti-Semitic comments from random individuals identifying themselves with Nazi code names. After shutting down the third in a row that night, Mayor Harrington turned to legal counsel.
City Attorney, if this continues to be a pattern, I'm not sure that I am interested in us providing a platform for folks to insert their hateful comments into our meeting.
City Attorney Bob Southard was just as disturbed as the counselors.
I mean, it's disruptive to this meeting besides being odious. And this council and this meeting does not have to listen to these people spout this filth.
Southard told the council it cannot require people to sign up beforehand, but it can put some sidebars on what's allowed. It's been a struggle back and forth ever since. The council adds new requirements for Zoom participants, or it scales back opportunities for virtual comment. And the trolls push back, squeezing in hateful comments in the moments before they're kicked out of the meeting. Throughout all of this, Laramie's city councilors have been left wondering, who's doing this? Jeremy Shaver, the Mountain West's regional director for the Anti-Defamation League, had a surprisingly specific answer.
The vast majority are the responsibility of an extremist group that holds virulent anti-Semitic beliefs.
The most likely culprits are the white supremacists who call themselves the Goyim Defense League. They have disrupted meetings across the country with similar tactics. These disruptions are usually carried out on Zoom. They'll log into the meeting virtually, then jam up public comments with hateful rhetoric until the government body is forced to close the comment period altogether. It happened once in Jackson and in several Colorado communities as well. Across the country, the group has disrupted more than 140 local government meetings since last summer. The disruptions in Laramie have not let up, and they take a toll on both the Laramie City councilors and staff, who have to carry on with the normal business of the city. Outside of the meetings, Harrington says it's incredibly difficult to make that shift.
Almost every week, it is a bunch of hateful stuff, and my heart gets racing, and like my face turns red, and I'm frazzled. And then I have to read a proclamation about something really great happening in the community, recognize a group doing good work, you know, something of that sort. And it's really hard to transition your brain from one of those things to the other.
Shaver says this attack on a local government's ability to even function is part of the point.
These extremists are hijacking these public comment periods, these opportunities for residents of local communities to participate in their local government.
The Laramie City Council has limited its open-ended public comment period to in-person comments only. For now, Zoom attendees can still comment throughout the meeting on specific agenda items. But the fascist disruptions are creeping into those parts of the meeting as well. At the most recent meeting, 5 full months since the first attack, Harrington preemptively warned the room before going to Zoom for public comment.
I'm just going to note for the folks in the room who have kids, these have gone off the rails a little bit in a way that you don't want your children to hear, probably.
The commenter tried to start, and Harrington told him to turn on his camera. The commenter did as he was asked, but appeared to have blocked the lens. The mayor, audibly weary in the face of another attempted disruption, told the city clerk to throw out their virtual guests.
Okay, we can remove this person. City clerk, I have a feeling I know where that's headed. If you do have a comment, please feel free to email the council. What a dumb thing we have to do.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jeff Victor.
2024 will go down as one of the biggest wildfire years in Wyoming on record. But crews were also battling low numbers of volunteers to help protect communities from these blazes. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger spent a lot of last year talking to firefighters.
Anytime I got to talk to firefighters, it was incredible. I mean, there were thousands of acres burned, millions and millions of dollars spent, low rates of volunteers to help fill the rosters. And yet, everyone I talked to walked away saying they love their job and they'll be here again next year to fight the fires of any size. That's just a level of resiliency that you don't see in a lot of interviews, and so I always enjoy talking to them.
Here's Uplinger on the shortage of firefighters.
Jumpers airborne in 1 minute.
So Jumpers, this is the Wings of Blue. These are the parachute guys.
Firefighters like Paul Creeks have been battling wildfire after wildfire this summer. But back in July, Creek's job as Laramie County Fire Authority Division Chief was to help out at Wings Over Warren Air Show in Cheyenne.
Today we've got a combination of paid staff working, residents, students working, and volunteer members to staff a truck during our air show to help our neighboring community and partners. And that's just, it's just fun to see.
Months prior to the air show, Craig Heelig invited me to ride along with his engine for the day and talk about volunteer recruitment.
Statewide, we've seen a decrease of volunteer firefighters.
Someone will still show up when you call, but the problem is big enough that lawmakers passed multiple laws addressing the situation directly.
The Wyoming State Rural Fire Association, along with State Forestry and a lot of the other partners, were able to get some bills passed to help mitigate that a little bit and get us some more volunteers.
Those bills provided volunteer firefighters with benefits like access to the state health care plan, time off for state employees to serve as volunteer emergency personnel, and access to cancer screenings. Nick Hudson is the fire inspector for Lander. He says it's too soon to say what kind of impact these new laws will have.
Most departments that I've talked to actively been recruiting, but it's just a struggle trying to get people to come in the door. Anything that you can do to try to help incentivize that and to make it a little bit more appealing, you know, might be beneficial.
Hudson says despite volunteer numbers remaining down, fire engines are ready to go 24/7. But the time of the fire might determine how many people show up to fight it.
So you only have so many people that are going to be able to show up during the day or during regular working hours. You might have people that volunteer that work night shift. They try to show up when they're not working, but there's a lot of times when you're at work, you just can't go to a call. And so you try to up your numbers or up your roster numbers so that way you have a higher percentage to draw from at any time that the call can come in.
So fire departments, ladders, and fire districts across the state are doing what they can for recruitment, but it's a battle they're not used to. Back at the Laramie County Firehouse, some of the longer-serving crew members say there was a time when the department used to recruit for itself. Back when fire season was a little shorter, departments used to be what many called a boys' club. It was exclusive, but their numbers remained high as firefighting was seen akin to a form of public service or a brothers-in-arms case, like the military. The public service importance remains true, but the fires are now larger, the risk is higher, and volunteering doesn't pay the bills. So how are firefighters fighting this?
All right, we are live in the command post.
Well, Halig has taken to quirky and engaging social media posts.
We just had our first call of a grass fire. Fire is out now, though.
Crick says showing up to college job fairs might help recruit volunteer and career firefighters. Hudson says he's seen departments putting out yard signs, holding cookouts, and reaching out to veterans. Jordan Zunaga, the business manager for Laramie County Fire, also has an idea to bring on new talent.
We have women in every single volunteer round that we've done since I've been here. So they are applying. They are starting to show up. They're just, you know, you'll get 15 guys for one girl. I think that, you know, in high school, kind of your like blue collar, your hands on, your more trade school stuff is pushed more to your male audience. So I think the biggest problem is it's just not made accessible or knowledgeable to women until they go out and find it themselves.
Fire departments aren't exactly sure how to overcome the dwindling volunteer numbers. They are sure that fighting fires remains a public necessity. And Paul Crick says it's never too late to get involved.
The deeper your bench is in those times of need, you know, I'd like to see as much participation as we possibly can get.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Up next, we'll hear about a program trying to heal intergenerational trauma on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Culturally informed care is at the core of the White Buffalo Recovery Center, an outpatient addiction treatment facility in Riverton and on the Wind River Reservation. Last summer, Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman got an inside look at a new program the center is standing up.
I got to spend the day with a bunch of the peer specialists who work there and just learn about what they do. Their passion and care for their community was super infectious. And the work they're doing is no small feat. Helping to break cycles of addiction, grief, and trauma caused by a long history of colonization takes a lot. And I was really inspired by the commitment and care of the people I interviewed.
Here is Haberman at the center.
At a white plastic table in an office in Arapahoe, Lance Oldman is pounding ground-up cedar into something a bit unexpected, an empty chapstick tube.
Fill it up with cedar and use a stick, push them out, and they come out. Perfect little cylindrical circles.
Oldman is Northern Arapahoe and is a certified peer specialist at White Buffalo. Cedar, he says, is traditionally used to heal the mind, body, and spirit.
We'll say a prayer and we'll put them on the hot charcoals.
But Old Man says burning cedar in that way isn't always possible. So he and his co-workers set about figuring out how to make cedar incense, which involved a lot of trial and error. But a tube of chapstick sitting on the table gave him a eureka moment.
Bing! You know, it was just that little flash. You know, it's like, all right, man. So I pulled it out, put some in there and pushed it out. And everybody's like, whoa, that's cool.
Making cedar incense is just one small part of what Old Man gets up to at White Buffalo. He's been working there for almost 10 years. The center supports all enrolled tribal members and tribal descendants, and offers both clinical services and a whole host of culturally informed programs run by peer specialists, like language and crafting classes, drumming, a 12-step medicine wheel program, and sweat lodges.
All our families and our communities are in need of this healing right here, right now.
Northern Arapaho tribal member Luke Brown agrees.
The solution to addiction is not abstinence. The solution to addiction is connection.
He works at the White Buffalo office in Riverton. One of his big roles as a peer specialist has been facilitating Mending Broken Hearts, a bi-monthly 3-day workshop that provides healing around grief, loss, and intergenerational trauma.
Mending Broken Hearts itself is an effort to help resolve unresolved grief and to complete some incomplete relationships. It helps us to look at where our trauma has stemmed from.
Brown says much of that trauma is rooted in colonialism.
From the wars, from the murder of our native people in the past, and moving forward into the boarding school system where our culture was outlawed and in a way beaten out of young children in the boarding schools. That type of history still affects us today.
In the past, the workshop has just been for adults, but now it's expanding to include the whole family. Brown will be co-facilitating the new program with Kenzie Monroe, White Buffalo's adolescent peer specialist. She says bringing young people into the workshop is a logical next step.
A lot of our adolescents are struggling, and they don't understand like where the grief is coming from or understand their feelings or healing, and so I think that's good to be a part of that.
Monroe is Northern Arapaho and recently went through the adult version of the Mending Broken Hearts workshop herself. She says she came away with a better understanding of the ripple effects of intergenerational trauma, and says bringing the learning to families will hopefully have a sort of reverse ripple effect.
There's going to be that understanding and that forgiveness and that ultimate healing. I think it's a good thing.
Back in Arapaho, Brandon Brown says drumming is one way he has found healing.
I grew up around the drum. I mean, my dad brought me to the drum at a very young age, and my earliest memories is falling asleep at the drum. So, you know, now I'm sitting there with him singing.
Brown is also Northern Arapaho and started working as a peer specialist 2 months ago. He grew up in an alcoholic home, but drumming and staying connected to his culture have helped him.
That's what helps me in my sobriety, is being at the drum and expressing myself. And when I sing, it's like our cultural songs, it's like praying.
Brown is 36 and wants to share that tool with others. He says a lot of the people he works with are a generation or two older than him and may have been severed from their culture, but he's grateful he can share what he knows with them.
They really connect with me, and they want to learn more, or they appreciate what I got to say, because what I say is true and honest.
Above Brown's desk is a large drum, its sides painted blue with a white bison. As he talks about it, his eyes light up.
He's circle because of life, the circle of life. And when we drum on him, he makes a beat. And that beat is a heartbeat. And it's not only his heartbeat, it's heartbeat of our tribe.
Brown points to the crisscrossing ties making triangles all around the outside of the drum, which he says represents mountains and teepees.
Not only is it his heartbeat, but it's my heartbeat. You know, it's my love. This is my passion. This is the drum.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Back in 2010, Wyoming had 855 licensed daycare centers. But in the last 14 years, a third of those have shut down. Meanwhile, the need for childcare is high. Last March, the town of Dubois, population 931, lost its only daycare. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards went to see a solution firsthand.
It was really cool to go to this beautiful small town and see these women who are just coming together and making real change in their communities. I promise, it had nothing to do with the fact that a little kid says the word poop in it.
Take a listen.
Not long ago, Tiny Tots Daycare was a hubbub of children's voices, infants all the way up to 5 years old. Jess Unger ran the center for 5 years and did her best to shuffle around 21 kids so their parents could work. She also had a long wait list, but couldn't afford the staff or rent to grow the school. So Unger realized she had to put an end to all that hubbub.
There's just no feasible way that, in Wyoming at least, in these smaller areas, that you'll ever have enough enrollment to make it work. I racked my brain for a long time.
The tipping point came when the school district opened a pre-kindergarten and Unger's whole class of older kids left. If she wanted to take on more younger kids, she'd need more teachers to adhere to guidelines. And that meant less income to keep the daycare alive. But Unger also just felt exhausted.
You're sick a lot because, kids just germs. I've been thrown up on. I've been used as a toilet. I've had other people's child snot in my mouth.
And she couldn't pay herself enough to make it worth it. After she closed, Dubois had zero licensed childcare. The closest was Lander or Jackson. Casey Sedlak's two boys were both forced to stay home. Sedlak runs a consulting business, plus helps run a ranch. Right away, her family went into emergency mode. Now Sedlak does whatever she has to do to keep them busy. Today, she's got them doing chores. 7-year-old Levi waters the flowers. 5-year-old Charlie takes care of the chickens. But 3-year-old Tilly says no chores for her.
I was supposed to do dog poop, but I hate dog poop.
But still, it isn't easy getting the kids settled down so that their mom can chat.
2020, sorry. Hey, that's not okay. There's no hitting, just help out. Just.
Since then, it's been hard to get her work done. A recent study on the childcare crisis in rural America shows that about 10,000 Wyomingites aren't able to work because of a lack of childcare. Sedlak asked other families about a nanny share.
The answer was, that's great. And then DFS was like, that's illegal. So I was like, wait, why? Why is that illegal?
One of the barriers to solving the childcare crisis is the number of regulations the Department of Family Services has about who's allowed to care for kids and how many. Wyoming currently says a nanny can only care for 2 unrelated children at a time. Sedlak was so perplexed by this, she testified to lawmakers at a committee meeting. It worked. Now they're drafting a bill to allow a nanny to care for up to 5 families. But Micah Richardson with the Wyoming Women's Foundation says, sure, it needs to be easier to get childcare, but lawmakers shouldn't throw out too many rules, like child caregiver ratios.
We have also heard from providers who are like, I don't want to have one person watching 20 kids like that. That is not helpful. That is stressful.
Potentially worsening caregiver burnout. What she really wants to see is some state funding to help parents afford care and to pay caregivers better. It's worth the money, she says. Since the childcare crisis, it's really a labor problem.
It just becomes a larger economic issue of having the support we need and the people available to do the jobs in Wyoming.
That's why parent Sarah Domek and other Dubois parents plan to reopen Tiny Tots under a new name, Little Lambs. They've applied for grants and are hosting fundraisers to raise the money. Inside, piles of toys and infant beds wait for a caregiver to put it all in order.
We've got the bathrooms and 2 rooms that can be used for napping, for nap time.
They also plan to use a new business model they hope will be less impacted by low child enrollment and staff turnover. Little Lambs will be a nonprofit daycare.
And it seemed to be the most sustainable model because you could tap into other granting sources and
That's what we want. We want sustainability.
For months, they've been trying to hire people to fill positions. Recently, they had a couple solid interviews. For Domek, it's urgent that this new daycare gets up and running. She works full-time for a conservation group and will desperately need childcare in a few months. She's expecting a baby any minute. Otherwise,
well, do we move to Pinedale for a few years and closer to my folks and they could help?
As for parent Casey Sedlak, she's optimistic that Wyoming can find a way.
When you live in a community that's this rural, you've got to get creative and you've got to say, like, okay, we've had to think outside the box to live here. How do we think outside the box to keep living here?
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Last year, a survivor of the Heart Mountain Japanese American confinement site returned to Wyoming. We hear about his experience.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
This is Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Last July, close to 200 former incarcerees and their families returned to a relocation camp in northwest Wyoming for the first time since World War II. During the war, around 14,000 Japanese Americans from across the country were forcibly relocated to the Heart Mountain Japanese American confinement site near Cody. Today, it's one of the best preserved relocation sites among the 10 camps that are mostly found in the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats joined a survivor as he and his wife revisited the area.
Listeners got to go on a tour of what some of the sites at Heart Mountain looked like, and these sites prompted Shuko to share memories. Listeners got to hear firsthand what it was like being there as a kid, the lighter moments, and also the challenging times.
Wheats takes us there.
Okay, shall we go for a walk?
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Let's head over somewhere where we can see the see the railroad, and we'll talk about what you remember seeing when you first got here.
Shuko Yoshikami, who's now 86, was just 4 years old when he, his parents, and three siblings were sent by train from Southern California to Heart Mountain. They spent about 3 years there. Shuko, his wife, and I visited a restored barracks and some other sites near the camp.
We arrived by train. What I do remember distinctly was looking out the window and seeing irrigation canals, water flowing. We're going one direction, so in the opposite direction, the water is flowing down. And I don't remember too much after that, but I do remember being in our barracks and being very cold because we came from Southern California. And so we had extra clothing on. Eventually, I think my parents had my mother had a pea coat, a navy pea coat, I remember. And my father had the army gray coat. The rest of us, we wore multiple clothing. And since we came from Pomona, we were just for summer. Hartman was good for kids like me, but not good for people who were just graduating college or high school and beginning the careers of life, and especially people who knew more of the law of the land. And I'm thinking of an exhibition I saw at the Smithsonian American History Museum. This was probably in the late 80s, and it was a teacher from Florin, California, and she said when she was incarcerated, and it was probably one of the internment centers like Tanforan, she saw her friends on the other side of the fence, and then she says, "And when the gates closed behind me, I knew I lost something. And I realized it was my constitutional rights as a U.S. citizen. And that hit me. You know, you don't think of those things as a kid. You're just living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. Thanks for sharing that. Let's walk over to where this barrack is, and we'll talk a little bit about life in the barracks and what you remember about living there.
Sure. This sort of looks like it, because this is tar paper and had these battens nailed down, and the door. Well, this is a bigger door, looks like our door because it had this, but it's, you know, regular house door size here. I remember seeing searchlights. They used to have searchlights, but that didn't last too long. But then that was by 40, but it had to be 44 because my brother was born in, and we were in block barrack three, barrack number 3 and 17. But we would lie out and look out, and you could see this. It's daylight still, you know, at 9 o'clock, and we're lying in bed, and we're supposed to be sleeping. You can't sleep, so we told stories.
Did you play any, like, ball games or the other kinds of just outdoor games that you played?
What kind of games we played? We played...
Alley over.
Oh, yeah, alley over, you know, throwing a tennis ball, very precious, a ball. And we'd throw the ball over the barrack, and the team on the other side, if you catch it, and that's honor system, you catch it, then you alley, alley over, ball's not coming over, and you come running around the other side and you throw the ball or touch somebody with the ball, and now they're poisoned, so they're on your side. And then so you gather, and the side that ends up with everybody is the winning side. Anyway, so everybody wins, I guess, in that game. That was lots of fun, and lots of running around and yelling and screaming. My kindergarten teachers were Miss Kamei, and her brother was a classmate of mine, and she was a kindergarten teacher. And that was when I came back from the hospital from pneumonia, because they had a Boy Scout parade in Block 17. I was watching it, and then my heart and my chest was sore, so I went home, and my mother says, "Oh, what are you doing home?" I said, "Oh, my chest hurts." Then the kids told her, she asked the kids, "What's wrong?" And the kids, they make up stories. "Oh, he got hit in the chest by baseball." "Oh, that's terrible." Talked to the doctor later on. He said, no, if he hit by chest, he'd be dead. He won't be moaning about the pain now. And so then Army car came and picked me up. I guess that's the ambulance. This is a four-door sedan, put in the hospital there. And my mother comes in a couple of days later, and nothing's happening to me. So she realized that she better get a real doctor in there.
They weren't helping you caring for you there?
I don't know. I don't know what they were doing. According to my mother, they weren't doing anything. So she went to her family doctor from Los Angeles, and she gave him $100. I don't know where she got the money from. And according to her, she said, "Oh, before you know it, they're taking x-rays, so might be." And I was diagnosed, I had pneumonia. And so I was in hospital there, and she visited me every day. I was there for about 10 days.
How do you think that your experiences here at Heart Mountain, at school, the friendships you made, also, you know, some of the times that may have been more challenging, shape who you became as an adult? Anything you feel like you learned from the experience?
Why do I remember so much? Because it was so different from the ordinary, and we're always moving, and you note the season, the time, and that's why I think I remember all these things, because things were changing. When everything's the same, you don't remember things. We remember change, and there are very drastic changes going from a place in Los Angeles, going to Pomona, and then coming to Heart Mountain. How am I feeling inside? Well, I just feel kind of happy. It may be strange, but what's nice is not the, I guess we could, all the cruelty and all the other things could be forgotten. But as we were riding up here from Salt Lake, my brother who was born here and my sister came as an infant. She remembers very little, so much so that she told her friend, "Oh yeah, we used to go up to hiking up Heart Mountain all the time." And the friend said, "Oh, Heart Mountain's so far away." Well, she was talking about the foothills that we went. But I hear they're chatting to each other, and I'm interjecting things that I remember. I thought, "Oh gee, I wonder if my parents would really be happy to be overhearing our conversation of the thing, because it formed our family, and it brought us closer together." Well, we were always close together, but it was the family, I think, that was important. And I think that's what Heart Mountain did, probably strengthen the family. Like these traumatic incidents in life shaping us. It's like forging a sword, you know. You got to beat the sword and you got to mix the metal and make it stronger. Otherwise, you'd be fragile and would break under any adversity.
That was Shuko Yoshikomi, a survivor of the Heart Mountain Japanese-American confinement site, speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. For people who've been to prison, the odds of returning there after being released are high across the board. That rate is estimated to be 33% higher for Native American people. On the Wind River Reservation, a new agency is trying to reduce the likelihood that tribal members will go back to prison. As Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reported, it's led by a member of the Northern Arapaho tribe.
I picked this one because Terry Smith's resiliency and optimism after struggling with addiction and going to federal prison stayed with me, even after I finished writing it.
Take it away, Clements.
Terry Smith is driving her white pickup truck across the storm-darkened community of Arapaho.
I know the Little Shields live here. I know the Whites live over here, last name Whites, T-Bearings over there.
Smith leads the Northern Arapaho Boston, Reentry right Agency as its only employee. It started up this year after the tribe got a federal grant. It's meant to help Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribal members coming from prison readjust to life on the reservation and stay out of jail. Smith barrels across flat pasture land and the occasional smattering of houses, all of it sitting at the feet of the Wind River Mountains. Her eyes are busy with memories.
The house burned down. So now there's like a camper there, and one of my aunts lives there because she has no place to go, and there's no electricity, no water, no nothing.
Difficulty finding housing is one of many hurdles people coming back from prison face. Smith was raised here and knows personally what can lead someone to get caught up with addiction and the law. That's because she was sentenced to 6 months in federal prison for conspiracy to distribute oxycodone.
I was away from my kids, I was away from my partner.
At the time, she was chief judge of the Wind River Tribal Court, but she lost her law license while in prison.
There's gonna be a lot of people who still view that side of me, but I know I've done the work to get better. You know, I did my time, I went to treatment.
She came home in 2021 and started over.
I'm so grateful to be able to pick my son up from school, to wake up and braid their hair, and to cook dinner for them.
When the funding for the reentry agency came through, a tribal leader told Smith to apply.
I honestly think this job's perfect for me right now, like, because I am getting a second chance. I want everyone to get that.
Smith turns into the town of Riverton.
We're going to pick up Tremaine. He's staying at Eagles Hope, right? It's a transitional living center.
Tremaine Thunder is a member of the Northern Arapaho tribe and Smith's first client. Thunder is one of 15 who she helps on a weekly basis. Last year, he was arrested and charged with illegal possession of a firearm.
When it came time for me to get released, I had nowhere to go. And that's where Terry. Terry came in. She helped me from the very start, even when I was in prison.
Smith helped him find a place to live when he got out.
She can relate to everything, as in all of it, you know, like the prison system, the probation system, being an addict, everything, you know. Her story inspires me so much, you know. It makes me want to do better, you know, because it can be done.
Smith also helps Thunder find a way to get to and from medical appointments and meetings with his federal parole officer.
If there's a document that I don't understand, I call her, you know, and it's just like, man, I don't understand this. Can you help me with it?
All right. Sure, you ready to go?
Yeah.
I think these programs are really important and long overdue.
Cheyenne Senator Afi Ellis is a member of the Navajo Nation.
To the extent that we can rely more on tribal governments and tribal courts to provide that those services, the better off I think everyone is.
Reentry services like Smith's are new to the Wind River Reservation and to many other tribal nations. Ellis says she supports Smith and the agency, but worries about its dependence on federal money.
We've seen this time and again in Indian country. Great idea, great program, here's some funding. Tribes get something going, and then money runs out, they lose the grant, and then the program's gone.
Back in Arapaho, Smith heads to the reentry agency office in Great Plains Hall.
This grant is just me in this office, right? That's all was written into that grant.
Smith says she looked to reentry agencies in Oklahoma and Minnesota for guidance on how to run hers.
In the meantime, she's petitioning to get her law license back so she can help clients like Thunder even more.
I got letters of recommendation from my attorney friends and from Lee, the councilman. So I hope it goes well.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Arapaho.
A mysterious illness in cattle and how a court case affected abortion access in Wyoming, coming up on Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to our year in review of Open Spaces.
Joyce Menke is a cattle rancher in Carbon County near Elk Mountain. In September, she started feeling not like herself.
I was very tired and running a low-grade fever all the time.
She thought maybe it was a bad cold. Not to mention, she was under a lot of stress. Her cattle were dropping dead, left and right.
This is nothing we have ever seen before.
But then Joyce got a rash on her arm.
It's got blisters on it, and it itches and burns.
And then she got a call from the state veterinarian about her cattle.
And that's when they told us we have anthrax.
That's right, anthrax. A disease that, before now, was basically unheard of in Wyoming. And in the U.S., it rarely infects cattle and almost never humans. But by this point, Joyce was wondering if she had it too. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan had the story of the anthrax outbreak in Elk Mountain and how its handling exploded some locals' mistrust in the state services that are supposed to keep us safe and healthy.
I was lucky enough to get in touch with one of the ranchers out in Elk Mountain, and they let me come out and told me their whole story. And the twists and turns that the story takes, I honestly couldn't have ever expected it.
Give it a listen.
Let's rewind to late August at the Menke Ranch. They did a routine check of their cattle and found
5 cows, 2 bulls, and a calf dead. And it was like, whoa.
Each day, more dead cows. Yet the cattle looked healthy otherwise.
Start questioning whether what the heck have you got.
Francis Menke is Joyce's husband, but he goes by his nickname.
Bug. Bug Menke.
Bug has a bushy white beard and camo suspenders. He's pretty much ranched all 72 years of his life. Bug's no stranger to losing cows, but not like this. Everywhere a cow died was a black outline.
It looked like somebody put oil on the ground. That's what it looked like.
He and Joyce opened up a carcass.
We both go, oh, wow, this is nothing we have ever seen before. Bloody, black, weird. It had this, I described it as like bloody tapioca pudding.
Bloody lesions all over the cow's insides.
And the liver was mush.
Joyce took a sample for the state vet lab.
Well, I tried to scoop this stuff up into the baggie and it wouldn't go. It would just stick. So I just reached in the body cavity, grabbed a handful of it up, put it in the bag, and wiped my hand in the bag and sealed the bag shut.
A few days later, they got that call from the state. The cows had anthrax. And it wasn't just the Menkes. Cows were dying at 2 other nearby ranches since June.
Nobody really knew nothing. They was reading in a book is what they were doing.
Because none of them had ever seen anthrax.
This is not the white powder that gets sent in the mail. This anthrax possibly dates back to the big cattle drives of the late 1800s. It's in the soil where it
just kind of sits and waits quietly.
Allie Brower heads up the state vet lab. She says we don't know why it resurfaces, possibly big droughts or floods, possibly flies transmitting it from one cow to the next.
But in Wyoming, there hadn't been any really clear cases of it. Some say the 50s, some say the 70s, but certainly not for a very, very long time.
So because of that, testing for it wasn't top of mind. That's why it took 8 days for the Menkes to almost 3 months for nearby ranchers to get a diagnosis from Brower's lab.
You know, you don't know things until you know them.
Brower says the ranchers, local veterinarians, and state agencies worked really well to figure it out. The Menkes let Brower and her team come out and examine dead cows after hours on Labor Day weekend. Joyce says those efforts saved a
bigger catastrophe around here. You know, how many more deaths would occur before I would not have gone to the doctor?
Remember Joyce's rash? It kept festering, a symptom of human skin anthrax. So she went to the Laramie Hospital and spent almost 4 hours there. Joyce says it felt disorganized and unprepared.
It was a calamity of failed health care.
The hospital says the Department of Health didn't call to prep them for Joyce's visit, but they say they still followed protocol, like running tests, which actually came back negative for anthrax. The Department of Health confirmed there were no positive human cases of anthrax. But Joyce says she doesn't buy it, and false negative tests can happen, according to the CDC. So Joyce went home with preventative antibiotics. But over the next few days, she got sicker. This time, she went to the hospital in Loveland, Colorado. Dr. Dana Saunders says they couldn't confirm anthrax, but is it possible Joyce had it?
In my mind, yeah. I just think the timing of the symptoms that she had, absolutely, I think so.
Colorado kept Joyce for 5 days, putting her on IVs, an anthrax vaccine, and keeping her on the antibiotics from the Laramie Hospital.
This is my pharmacy. Yeah. We're on so many drugs.
Joyce is healing up at the ranch now. Bug's actually on those antibiotics, too.
It was a 60-day sentence.
It's a mean drug.
The pills are mostly preventative. If you were around the anthrax cows, you were exposed.
There's quite a few people around here that are on the cockeyed stuff.
Several months after it all, people like the Mankeys are reflecting on how the cattle anthrax and human health scares were handled. They're disillusioned. Allie Brower at the State Vet Lab thinks that trust was lost in the aftermath, a communication breakdown. She says state agencies weren't talking enough with each other to debrief.
We just drop the ball as soon as the problem is done, over and over again. We're just on to life as usual.
Which means little follow-up with those who lived the trauma, the ranchers.
They feel abandoned because they are abandoned.
Brower says more face-to-face time could validate ranchers' fears. Without that, trust is lost.
And then that primes people to be less interested in helping out public health or regulatory services in the future.
Back at the Mankey Ranch, Bug takes us for a quick tour. One orphan survivor licks the microphone.
I gathered him up and brought him in here and fed him out of a bottle.
Bug vaccinated all the survivors for anthrax, but they still lost 30 cows. Yeah. That's at least $30,000. There's potentially federal money that could help, but Joyce says they don't want it.
We just don't participate. We're self-reliant.
That's partly because of their mistrust of government even before, and now after anthrax?
Just reinforce it a little more. That's the best way to put it. How's that?
They still have a lot of questions, too. When will Joyce feel back to normal? And there's a pile of dead anthrax cows buried just over the hill. No one knows what that'll do to the ground, next year's hay crop, the nearby river. Bug is a man of few words, but when asked if he feels like his multi-generational ranch is infected.
Yep.
But here's what we do know. There's cheap, effective cattle vaccinations, and anthrax is on Wyoming's radar now, so people can act quicker. As for rebuilding trust, the Mankeys say they're open to it, but that the ball is in the state's court now. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Elk Mountain.
In November, a state judge struck down 2 abortion bans in Wyoming. The decision hinged almost entirely on a constitutional right Republicans fought for in the wake of the passage of the Federal Affordable Care Act. It allows residents to make their own health care decisions. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reported on this decision after 2 years following the issue.
I really liked this story because I felt like I could finally take a step back and ask, what's behind this judge's decision? What's the context here? And why is what's happening in Wyoming different than in the rest of the country?
On a stormy winter evening, the Teton County District Judge sent out an email. There was a new ruling in Wyoming's ongoing legal battle over abortion rights. Jovanina Anthony is a women's health provider based in Jackson.
I think it might be time to have a glass of wine for sure.
That's because Anthony has been fighting this battle for the last few years. She was one of several advocates who sued the state after it passed two near-total abortion laws, which never fully went into effect because of the litigation.
So I honestly now just heard about this, 5 minutes ago? I just feel this wave of relief washing over me as I think about the women of this state and other states who are continuing to fight for their rights.
She's been waiting 11 months for this decision, but the legal ruling has roots that date back to 13 years ago.
Senate will come to order.
Back in 2011, Wyoming lawmakers gathered on the Senate floor to talk about changing the state's constitution. It was the second reading of the proposed amendment.
There's four paragraphs. First one is, each competent adult shall have the right to make his or own her health care decisions.
Senator Drew Perkins led the charge. The amendment was in response to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Republicans were fuming. They were worried that people would be forced into the federal health care system.
And that's what this is about, my fellow senators, I think, is about choice, about whether you're going to free to choose it, whether you're free not to choose it.
The next year, over 75% of Wyoming voters ultimately approved the amendment, giving the right to make health care decisions. The same happened in a handful of other conservative states, such as Arizona and Oklahoma. That's according to Mary Ziegler, a historian and law professor at the University of California.
It was just sort of like a messaging bill, right, where Republicans were using it to signal disapproval, you know, to message to voters what they thought they were losing with the Affordable Care Act.
But Ziegler says that health care access amendment has come back to bite Republicans, who now want to ban abortion. In the ruling, the district court judge wrote, "The abortion bans violate the right to make health care decisions for an entire class of people, pregnant women." Ziegler says in the flurry of abortion cases we've seen since Roe v. Wade was overturned, this is a new tactic. Other states are using different parts of the Constitution.
Addressing due process or equal protection or the right to life or bodily integrity, like things that are less specifically healthcare focused.
But with Wyoming's constitutional amendment in her back pocket, the Teton County judge argued that abortion is protected since it counts as healthcare, according to dictionary definitions and medical associations. The state of Wyoming and anti-abortion groups, though, disagree.
Abortion is not healthcare.
Marty Halverson runs the group Wyoming Right to Life. Back on that stormy night, she had been out shoveling snow and was still processing the news.
It destroys the two-patient paradigm and allows one patient to be killed and somehow benefiting the other patient.
Governor Mark Gordon has already directed his legal team to appeal the ruling, saying he's committed to defending the sanctity of life.
Wyoming Right to Life is looking forward to the appeal to the Wyoming Supreme Court.
Even so, Wyoming's legislative session is coming up in January, and both political sides are already planning to introduce laws to further back their belief. Democrats have said they'll introduce a bill enshrining the right to abortion, and a couple of Republicans are saying they want to place more guardrails on doctors prescribing abortion pills. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
Thank you for listening to this special recap of 2024 on Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.